Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like saddles, pistols, and of course, the Wild West.
Now, Sam, there's a clue there, in there somewhere, somewhere hidden in there, about the inspiration for this week's podcast. However, for the moment, we will be simply following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of chaos is in fact all about the Cultural Revolution in China? It's about the science of unpredictability. It's about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's about lawless hours and days, social anarchy, and the lords of misrule. Who knew? Or who knew that the history of switches is in fact all about cheating death? It is. It's all about cheating death. Switching on Christmas lights, the history of celebrity, the nuclear button via World War II, and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
All such important history for you there. The Lords of Misrule, James, I particularly remember being a very good one. You're all probably wondering who this person is telling you all of this wonderful information. Let me just say of my fellow presenter that if history was bad and ugly, he would be good in his intentions to tell the world about the past. Or perhaps even better, if history was good, he would be the bad and ugly cowboy of research, labouring under the hot noon sun of the library. If history was Butch, he would be Sundance, the history kid, enriching us all with a fistfuls of historical dollars we can spend in the present. That was very good. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. You've had fun writing that, haven't you? I could tell.
I did.
We're on a similar wavelength, because you may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a cowboy-related historian, he'd only be the man with no name, a.k.a. the Clint Eastwood of the history world. So steely is his nerve in the face of an overwhelming historical quest. So cold and calculating is he in dispensing justice to historical bad guys of yesteryear. So quick-fingered is he in the gunslinging arena that is modern-day historiography. Graphical debate. So cool, iconic, and dude-like is he as he rides off into the historical sunset, having righted the wrongs of the past. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Yeehaw Willis.
Well, that's it. That's the end of the podcast.
Yes,
I think we've impressed you all there. If you haven't worked it out yet, guys, we're doing cowboys. Very excited to do so, and have been both inspired to do so by the fabulous new Netflix film The Harder They Fall. So I think that before we start exploring the idea of cowboys and how it helped us think about the past in new and interesting ways, we should hear a little bit about the film. So let me hand over to our Histories of the Unexpected resident film critic, James Daybell.
Sam, that's wonderful. This was a terrific film. The Harder They Fall by James Samuel is a Western. But it's a Western with a difference. It is a Western that has an entirely black cast. And I thought this was an absolute tour de force. The whole thing is a revenge Western. So you see the outlaw, Nat Love, played by Jonathan Majors, who discovers that his enemy, played by the brilliant Idris Elba, who I absolutely love, is being released from prison. And so basically, Nat Love reunites his gang to track down Rufus Buck, who also has his own gang, and they seek revenge. Now, this is on limited release in cinemas. It's out on Netflix on the 3rd of November. So, and it's well worth a watch. I thought it was stunning cinematography, uber stylish, strong characterization. There are all the sort of big ticket items of that you'd expect from Westerns: trains, landscapes, big skies. It's a sort of homage to the spaghetti Western, so there are echoes of classic movies like Django. The title itself, I think, is a respectful nod to the 1972 Jamaican modern Western starring Jimmy Cliff, which is the Harder They Come. And several characters in this film have names of legendary real-life cowboys and cowgirls. It's also Tarantino-esque in many of the echoes that it has to films like Kill Bill, Django Unchained, but maybe these are drawing on these earlier influences. It's a revenge narrative, which I think is really interesting. It's also got an almost entirely black cast, and it reminded me of Spike Lee's recent film The Five Bloods, which is also on Netflix, which is a black Vietnam movie, or that fantastic movie Glory, which was all about the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment, the Union Army's first African-American regiment in the American Civil War, which had brilliant performances by Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, and Denzel Washington won an Oscar for the Best Supporting Actor role. It's also got a stunning soundtrack, an entirely sort of black music soundtrack from rap and hip-hop, reggae, slave chants, scat singing, gospel choir, funk, musical, ballads, a cappella, even whistling, Motown and cowboy songs. So it's a real celebration of black music. Looking at the credits at the end, it also has an extraordinarily long stunt cast because it is full of action. It's action-packed. And it has a roll call of amazing actors. I've already mentioned Idris Elba, who just sort of burns off the screen. But also another of my favourite actors, Delroy Lindo, who I remember so well from Spike Lee's film Clockers, which is an extraordinary movie if you've never seen it. And Lindo as the Marshal is absolutely stunning in this. In terms of projecting or presenting the Black Wild West, I think this is something that is recovering an important history of the past, and that's something that I want to explore later on in the podcast. But I also think putting it on film is really important, and it echoes Public Enemy's song Burn Hollywood Burn, which if any of you have listened to the Fear of a Black Planet album will know all about that. And it's basically about, it's a rejection of tokenistic black characters in Hollywood movies and the need to actually, you know, have black Hollywood movies. And I think that's something that's really important and really comes across here. The other thing that I'd just like to end on is the strong female characters. Now, it's often a feminist test of a movie that if it is a feminist movie and if it actually treats female characters seriously, you have to have at least three female characters whose names you know. And there are three really strong female characters in here who are part of the different gangs. Treacherous Trudy and Stagecoach Mary Fielding being two such characters who play a really sort of wonderful part here. And most of the time we think about the Wild West as basically white and male. And I think what this film does is it adds really important correctives, not only the sort of African-American representation in the Wild West, but also the role that women played. So on the whole, I thought this was an outstanding film, Sam, in so many ways, so well shot, great soundtrack, well acted. You know, a really, really enjoyable movie. And if you like, if you like films, if you like Tarantino, if you like Idris Elba, if you like all of those kinds of things, if you like Spike Lee movies, this is something absolutely for you.
Yeah, it was very clever, and I kept on watching it, saying, I was watching it with my son, and every time there was another kind of cool setup, I was like, oh, that's a really cool shot. That was really, really clever, yeah. And it made me think about all sorts of things. Like my wonderful shot of them having a standoff in Redwood Town,
yeah.
And it was shot from above, and you could see the length of their shadows. Basically, their shadows were longer than the people that were standing up. And without telling you what was going on, it was pretty clear that it was the noonday sun which was casting those shadows. Fascinating. I particularly liked Delroy Lindo as well, and he raises an interesting point actually, as does the main characters. But right at the beginning of the film, they say, you know, although the story has been invented, these people actually existed. And it firmly has one foot in the past, this film. And it is based on a decent amount of research, and they are not completely invented people. Delroy Lindo, in particular, he plays the marshal, the sheriff. I forget his exact rank now, but he's a law enforcement officer, and he plays Bass Reeves. And Bass Reeves was the first black deputy U.S. marshal west of the Mississippi, who was renowned for 3,000 arrests of dangerous criminals, and he shot and killed 14 of them allegedly in self-defense. And a pretty terrifying man. And James, he actually reminded me a bit of the child catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, because he has the most sinister horse-drawn prison. Like a little cage, which he tows behind his horse, which is just what happens with the child catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But a bit more realistic and violent than that. Very, very impressive stuff. So, as you said, it's essentially what we're doing here is shining a light on the African-American cowboy in the Western frontier in the late 19th century. It's been an important but small, hopefully it will grow, area of historical inquiry. And I think the main point here is that histories of the Wild West seldom mention the large number of blacks who left the South, not for the North, as many people might suspect, because this is all tied up in the Civil War. There's a key scene in the film where there's a confrontation between one of the gangs and some Civil War soldiers. So it's a real reminder of the broader narrative of what's going on in America. But the point here is it's not just about blacks leaving the South and heading to the North, because the North were fighting against slavery. It's about all of those who left the South and headed to the West. And I think one of the other interesting things with the scale of the number of black cast, it made you realise that it's not just about the black cowboys, because you've got a huge amount of people who are moving to the West, not just to be cowboys. They became miners, farmers, soldiers, housewives, publishers, hotel owners, restaurateurs, barbers, politicians, whatever it might be. So there is a much broader subject going on here, which is definitely focused on by the film, James.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that idea of the historical research that's sort of woven through this is really important. I mean, the reviews that I read about James Samuel himself is that he grew up watching cowboy movies, as I did as well. I used to watch them every Saturday afternoon with my father and remembered all of those John Wayne westerns, and they were overwhelmingly white. And so in a sense, Hollywood has presented a particular myth about the Wild West. And one of the things that James Samuel wanted to do was actually produce a black Western. And what he's done, as you've said, is stitch together these sort of historical characters that come from across time and across periods and brought them all together. And there are some real live historical accounts that survive from them. And one of the main characters, Nat Love, has written a memoir that survives, which is extraordinary. And this is somebody who grew up as a slave and then managed to spend quite a bit of time, acting as a cowboy. And I just want to read you some extracts from his memoir, if I can here. So he's written in 1907 an autobiography, which basically recount stories of his life on the frontier. And there are all sorts of things here. He describes in one of the chapters a wild Mustang hunt. He describes being attacked by Native Americans. They go off with the food wagon and kidnap the cook, for example. But then one of the most interesting passages that I came across was that he's not there at the Battle of Little Bighorn, but he is in the region of it, and he hears all about one of the most famous battles of the Wild West, Custer's Last Stand, where they are wiped out by the combined forces of the Sioux, the Cheyenne, and the Apache Indians, so the 7th Cavalry Regiment. And this is in June 1876. And I just want to read you a little extract of this here. So he talks about, we'd not been on the trail long before we met other outfits who told us that General Custer was out after the Indians and that a big fight was expected when the 7th US Cavalry General Custer's command met the Crow tribe and other Indians under the leadership of Sitting Bull, Rain in the Face, Old Chief Joseph and other chiefs of lesser prominence who had for a long time been terrorising the settlers of that section and defying the government. As we proceeded on our journey, it became evident to us that we were only a short distance behind the soldiers. When finally the Indians and soldiers met in the memorable battle, or rather massacre, in the Little Bighorn Basin on the Little Bighorn River in northern Wyoming, we were only 2 days behind them, or within 60 miles, but we did not know that at the time, or we would have gone to Custer's assistance. We did not know of the fight or outcome until several days after it was over. It was freely claimed at the time by cattlemen who were in a position to know and with whom I talked that if Reno had gone to Custer's aid, as he promised to do, Custer would not have lost his entire command and his life. So there we are, Sam. There is a sort of a window, a spotlight on a very sort of well-known historical event in the history of the Wild West from the perspective of Nat Love, who is an African-American cowboy and one of the main characters in the film.
Yeah, and do you know what? What I really liked about the film also was you get a very clear sense that these people are temporary cowboys. So right at the beginning, you see a kind of the prehistory of what's going on. And it really is a reminder that being a cowboy was not by any stretch of the imagination necessarily the only thing that defined these people. Very often they might start off being cowboys at a certain stage in adulthood. So you've got the whole kind of their childhood to get through. And after that, many of them became store clerks, farmers, railroad employees, cooks, or worked in any number of industries. And that, I love that idea of the, you know, each and every cowboy having a different biography, a different personal history. So you need to be careful when you're thinking about cowboys, and you don't kind of group them all into one. I suppose that's the more general point that's being made by the film. So yes, we got it wrong thinking that all the cowboys were white. Now we know that there were so many more African-American cowboys, but also even within black cowboys or white cowboys, everyone kind of ended up working there for a different reason. They had a different experience of the Wild West. And I found a wonderful story of from Nat Love's biography as well. It's when he first gets drunk when he's a kid. It was fantastic. I thought this was important because alcohol plays quite an important part in the film, as it does with all Westerns. So that someone's lost a demijohn full of strong liquor and the kids go out and find it. It was several days later, while passing through the garden, that we ran across the lost demijohn. It did not take us long to discover that its contents suited our tastes. Sally and Jordan dragged it into a sweet corn patch, where we were safe from observation. An oyster can was secured to serve as a glass, and the way we attacked that wine was a caution to the temperance workers. And I can assure you we enjoyed ourselves for a while. But for how long? I'm unable to tell exactly. Mother soon missed us, but being very busy, she could not look for us until evening. When she started out to look for us up, after searching and calling in vain, she decided to take the dogs to help find us. With their aid, we were soon located lying in the sweet corn, dead drunk, while the demijohn, quite empty, bottom side up, stared at Mother with a reproachful stare. And the oyster can, which had served up and took me to the house and let Sally and Jordan lie in nearby, bearing mute witness against us. Mother picked me up and took me to the house and let Sally and Jordan lie in. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And clearly from a man who's very talented at writing, which raises a very interesting question about the literacy of slaves and slavery and black literacy in the South. Because there were laws against it, but obviously people found their way around it. Here is Nat Love was actually educated by his father. So I love the story, James, and the concept of everyone having their own biography and their own story, you know, as a warning to historians not to generalise when thinking about the Wild West.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the sort of main things. Whenever you try and categorise people, there's always so much sort of individual variation and differentiation by class, by personality, by religion, you know, all sorts of factors that mean that the past is really detailed and nuanced. Before we move on, I just want to fill in a little sort of background on the history of black cowboys. There's a really quite extensive literature that exists, and I just want to talk through a couple of things that were really useful. William Lauren Katz's The Black West, you should look out for that. There's also a collection called Black Cowboys in the American West, On the Range, On the Stage, Behind the Badge, which is edited by Bruce A. Glassrud and Michael N. Searles by University of Oklahoma Press. Glassrud has also teamed up with Deborah Lyles to edit a collection called Before Emancipation, Black Cowboys and the Livestock Industry, another volume that's come out by the University of Oklahoma Press. If you're looking for something shorter and a sort of shortcut to it, there's a brilliant piece that I read in the Smithsonian Magazine by a scholar called Katie Nojimbadam, which is from 2017. And it's the lesser-known history of African-American cowboys. And what this takes is the idea that they're actually not that prevalent in popular narratives, in popular culture. But it is estimated that in the second half of the 19th century, some 5,000 to 8,000 cowboys were of African-American descent. And although this isn't the kind of thing that Hollywood portrays, this is something that, you know, that historians have uncovered. And as you were saying, Sam, I think part of it is this move of black slaves to the West, not just to the North. But it also focuses on Texas. And Texas, ever since the Spanish had colonized that sort of area in the 1500s, it was an important part of the country for cattle. And cattle farming became really important there economically and culturally in the late 1800s, when you've got millions of cattle in that area. You've got white Americans then moving into Texas, which is not part of the United States at this point, but they move there for cheap land. And of course, they take along with them the slaves that they had at home, and they establish their settlements upon this frontier. They establish cotton farms and cattle ranches, and you've got an estimated 25% of the Texas settler population that are slaves at this point. So Texas joins the Confederacy in 1861, and then although the Civil War isn't fought in Texas, Texans, in particular white Texans, go and fight alongside their Confederate comrades. And what this means is that the land is left to be looked after, often by the slaves. So they are there for, you know, looking after the land, herding the cattle. And also, you need to think about the importance of cowboys during this period from technology. In a sense, what you have is just huge open areas. Well, two things. Huge open areas, there's no barbed wire, and so cowhands are important to round up the cattle. And that's why cowboys are important there. It's also pre the sort of real sort of acceleration of transportation by rail. And so when white Texans want to sell their cattle for meat or hides or whatever into the North, you basically have these huge cattle drives. And what this means is that they're often relying on slaves. And then when the slaves are free, they're relying on black labour to act as cowboys. And during the Civil War period, a lot of the black slaves become very skilled in the various sort of activities that cowboys are involved in. There's then a really interesting thing towards the end of the 19th century, with the railroads becoming much more prominent as a mode of transportation of cattle. So you don't need so many cowboys to do these drives. What you effectively get is the demise of the cowboy. And so there are far fewer cowboys needed. And so what you find is that people who were cowboys are having to go into other kinds of trades. Nat Love, for example, you know, is one of these people who has to leave the cattle industry. He goes into the rodeos for a while, but also he's a Pullman porter. So he actually works on the railroad. There's then some really interesting history about how black cowboys were treated, not only by society, but also within their groups of cowboys. There's some interesting work about that they were actually discriminated against, that they were given, you know, typically given the sort of harder, more menial tasks, that sometimes when they went into settlements, into towns, into saloons, they were segregated. But there is also a lot of evidence in the literature that I've read that there was some degree of equality among cowboys, and there's tales of them sharing blankets, and when they're in gunfights, when they're defending themselves against external threats, against attacks, you know, they are, you know, it doesn't matter whether they are, you know, black or white, and they, you know, back each other up. So there's a really interesting history to get into there, Sam.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Yeah, I love that. And what you were mentioning is something that I'd also come across. And you were saying, talking about sharing a blanket, which I quite liked. The ethics and morality of cowboys and the code by which they lived is a very, very strong theme in the film. Yes, it's a revenge, but to have a revenge, you need to have a kind of an unspoken understanding of what is acceptable behaviour and what isn't acceptable behaviour. And the really interesting relationship here is between the cowboy's sense of justice, their belief in how they should actually behave, and what the law wants. And it's all very hazy. There are lots of grey areas. Nonetheless, historians they're very certain that the cowboys did exist with an unwritten code. Now, it poses an interesting problem for historians when you're trying to find unwritten rules, because you can't go and find the cowboy code as it was printed down and see what it actually was. It's more of a process of reading around the book, reading diaries, reading descriptions of events, and sort of finding out the rules by which people lived. Now, since historians have become aware that there was a unwritten code of conduct, there have been attempts to write it down. And this is just a few of them here, which I really liked. Never steal another man's horse. A horse thief pays with his life. Defend yourself whenever necessary. Look out for your own. Remove your guns before sitting at the dining table. Never order anything weaker than whiskey, which I quite liked. Cowboy doesn't talk much, he saves his breath for breathing. That's something that definitely doesn't apply for the film. There's a great deal of wonderful, wonderful narrative and talking. A cowboy always helps someone in need, even a stranger or an enemy. Be hospitable to strangers. Anyone who wanders in, including an enemy, is welcome at the table. The same was true for riders who joined cowboys on the range. This is important. Respect the land and the environment. And you really get a sense of that from these people who A lot of the action happens in towns, but a great deal of it happens out of towns in the wilderness, and the relationship between man and horse is very clear indeed. Honesty is absolute, your word is your bond. Now, on top of this, there are all sorts of other ones which come up in the film, particularly giving someone a chance. You have to fight fair. There's one bit where someone's shot in the back and it's appalling. I think it's sort of even within this. So they're breaking the law, but there are rules as to how they go about it and how they respect each other. Now, what's really interesting about this, I came across the most wonderful article, and it argued that there are two bodies of people in American historical culture who shared the same belief systems. One was cowboys and the other was the hippies of the late 1960s. And I thought, this is absolute nonsense. Until you start realising how the cowboys enjoyed freedom. They enjoyed their environment. They enjoyed nature, wilderness, living by a code of honour. And there's a great deal of stuff that actually transposes very clearly between the cowboy life of the late 19th century and hippies of the 1960s. There's a wonderful poem called The Cowboy and the Hippie. It was written by a chap called Chris LeDoux, who was a world champion bronco rider. And he was also North America's foremost rodeo song composer. And he tells a wonderful story, autobiographical, about... it starts off making the point that cowboys and hippies never really get along, but then he has an experience that changes his mind. So he's down on his luck. He's on a lonely desert highway. A lot of these visuals so important in all cowboy songs. And this rodeo cowboy finds himself alongside a hippie, real groovy, long-haired kind of wastrel from the 1960s. He calls him a long-haired freak. And they sat there chatting. And then the poem carries on, while the morning sun rose high, when a hot desert breeze commenced to blow, and the fragrance of the incense and 6 weeks without a bath finally drifted down and reached the cowboy's nose. Well, man, that really did it. He couldn't take no more, and he tied his old bandana around his face. He said, "You greasy, stinking hippie, you'd put a skunk to shame. Boy, you're a disgrace to the human race." Which sets up this really interesting kind of banter between the hippie and the cowboy. And the hippie gives him a few of his own jibes, pointing out how filthy the cowboy is. He's covered in cow crap and horse crap, and he smells of wildlife. And the cowboy takes offence to this. He says, "I'm not going to take that from you." And he challenges the hippie to a fight. But the hippie says, "No, let's not do that, because fighting never settles anything anyway." And then they start to realise how much actually they've got in common. And instead of fighting, they end up on rather good terms. There's a wonderful bit here where he says, "We both love our freedom. We'll answer to no man. And you've heard it said, to thine own self be true. We're just a couple of free spirits drifting across the land, doing exactly what we want to do." Said, "Now me, I got my things and you got yours, and I don't see why we can't get along. They say the closest thing to freedom is living on the road in a country where freedom's almost gone." So it's a wonderful poem celebrating the free wandering lifestyle, which applies equally to these two. And actually, if you study this whole period of the late 1960s, you realise how important cowboy culture was to it. The Byrds' landmark album, The Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and James, you may know, well, there are so many John Denver classics, Flying Burrito Brothers, but a wonderful James Taylor song, 1970s, called Sweet Ooh, Baby I do, James, yes. Which is possibly one of my favourite songs. And I've always thought it was weird. And then he's writing about... Well, it's a proper kind of cowboy hippie theme set to a sort of a waltz. And he's talking about hitchhiking the turnpike from Stockbridge to Boston. It's about a young cowboy who lives on the range. And a horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle. He sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to tame. And then it ends talking about having 10 miles behind me and 10,000 more to go. There's a song that they sing when they take to the highway, a song that they sing when they take to the sea, a song that they sing of their home in the sky. The singing works just fine for me. So I'm going to end it there, but it's a really important parallel here between the culture in the 1960s, what's going on there. It's quite complex with the politics, but a love of life And if you don't know what I'm talking about, think about Easy Rider. Okay, so late 1960s, it's exactly this period, and you've got two hippie heroes. They're roaring on motorcycles, they go into the Wild West, and they then spend the entire film enjoying rural living and enjoying celebrating the Western lifestyle. So I thought that was particularly surprising, James, but it also makes you realise how many of these themes and the code of honour, which is where I began, particularly is visible throughout a lot of American culture throughout history, not just cowboys.
Oh, Sam, that's excellent. May I pick up that baton of honour culture that you talked about and relate it to medieval chivalry in Europe? Because because one of the things that really struck me was the scene between the two gunslingers, the fast-drawing Jim Beckwith, who's a character who's constantly obsessed with his own ability, with his pistols, yeah, flashy trick work, spinning them round, versus Cherokee Bill, and they stand up against each other. And what this harks back to is really the medieval and 16th and 17th century duel in Europe that was incredibly popular, a way of solving disputes between two people who were at odds with each other. And actually, this gets imported into the southern part of the United States in the second half of the 19th century from the south. So from Mexico, it comes upwards. And it actually is a way that, you know, particularly young teenagers, people who are, who are battling with each other and tussling over rank and status and get into fights with each other. It is a custom that would have been used to sort out battles and disagreements that they'd had. And I think the interesting thing is that this is actually a very sort of small phenomenon. You know, there are sort of a handful of recorded historical examples of this. But yet it becomes a huge motif, not only in Western films, but also in Western pulp fiction that you get towards the end of the 19th century. You know, think about how many films that you've seen where you've had, you know, two gunfighters who square up to each other. And they count on the count of three, you know, we'll you know, shoot each other. That very, very rarely happened. And also all of these tricks that people play is almost an entire invention of the Western genre, because, you know, people who were really serious about killing people didn't mess around with that kind of thing. There's a lovely quote from Wyatt Earp, one of the sort of most famous law enforcement cowboys of his generation. And he says, "The most important lesson I learned was that the winner of a gunplay usually was the one who took his time. The second was that if I hoped to live on the frontier, I would shun flashy trick shooting, grandstand play, as I would poison." I don't know why I'm turning into an American accent here. It's
brilliant.
In all my life as a frontier peace officer, I did not know a really proficient gunfighter who had anything but contempt for the gun fanner or the man who literally shot from the hip. And so there's been a whole industry of historical work done on myth busting these myths that have been put into Westerns. So the idea that you would wear your holster, your belt, really low on the hips, that would allow you to sort of pull quick draw, is absolute nonsense. And actually the evidence for those people who were quick drawers was that before you have these sort of metal lined holsters, you had very sort of soft leather. This is all about the history of leather, Sam. Very soft leather holsters, because as a cowboy, you'd be often in the saddle and you'd need something that was quite comfortable for wearing. If you were serious about quick drawing and didn't want the gun to get caught in the holster while you were pulling it out, you would actually have the holster tied to the leg. And the other thing is that this idea that, you know, the goodies would basically injure or maim or shoot guns out of people's hands. I mean, this is absolute nonsense as well. People who were serious about shooting would shoot to kill. And the idea that you could shoot a gun out of somebody's hand is absolute nonsense. And there's a sort of mythbuster in history who's done the experiment looking at that kind of at shooting of guns in people's hands. And of course, as you know, having done your sort of series on weapons, if you shoot a gun like that, the bullet is going to come apart anyway, and then the gun would explode in somebody's hand. It's not something that's particularly clean. I think there are also a few well-known examples of famous duels, and one of them gets recorded in 1867 in Harper's Weekly. It's an article by George Ward Nichols, and it's in February, month of February of that period, and it refers to a duel on the 21st of July 1865, so a year and a half before, in Springfield, Missouri, between Wild Bill Hickok and Davis Tutt. And there's a big sort of quarrel over cards. They decide to have a gunfight. They walk out and face up to each other. And it's recounted in some detail, and I just want to share a little bit of that with you. So the main features of the story of the duel were told me by Captain Honesty, who was unprejudiced. With a name like that, of course he would be, if it is possible to find an unbiased mind in a town of 3,000 people after a fight has taken place. I will give the story in his words. They say Bill's wild. Now, he isn't any such thing. I've known him going on to 10 years, and he's as civil a disposed person as you'll find hereabouts. But he won't be put upon. I'll tell you how it happened. But come into the office. There's a good many round here as sides with Dave Tutt, the man that's shot. But I tell you, 'twas a fair fight. Take some whiskey. it's just really sort of intimate conversation he's having here. No, well, I will if you find blah, 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 blah. You see, continued the captain, Bill was up in his room playing 7-up and 4-hand, or some of them pesky games. Bill refused to play with Tutt, who was a professional gambler. You see, Bill was a scout on our side during the war, and Tutt was a Reb scout. Bill had killed Dave Tutt's mate, and between one thing and another, there were unusual hard feeling atwixt them. And so he goes on that they fall out over cards, blah, 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 and we'll just go down. They then have a sort of an altercation over the cards. Bill walks away. He's then goaded by people to sort of get into a fight. Next day, about noon, Bill went down to the square. He said that Dave Tutt shouldn't pack that watch across the square unless dead men could walk. When Bill got onto the square, he found a crowd standing in the corner of the street by which he entered the square, which is from the south, you know. In this crowd, he saw a lot of Tutt's friends. Some were cousins of his just back from the Reb Army, and they jeered him and boasting that Dave was going to pack that watch across the square as he promised. Then Bill saw Tutt standing near the courthouse, which you remember is on the west side, so that the crowd were behind Bill. Just then, Tutt, who was alone, started from the courthouse and walked out into the square, and Bill moved away from the crowd toward the west side of the square. About 15 paces brought them opposite to each other and about 50 yards apart. Tutt then showed his pistol. Bill kept a sharp eye on him, and before Tutt could point it, had his out. At that moment, you could have heard a pin drop in that square. Both Tutt and Bill fired, but one discharge followed the other so quick that it's hard to say which went off first. Tutt was a famous shot, but he missed this time. The ball from his pistol went over Bill's head. The instant Bill fired, without waiting to see if he had hit Tutt, he wheeled on his heels and pointed his pistol at Tut's friends, who had already drawn their weapons. "Aren't you satisfied, gentlemen?" cried Bill, as cool as an alligator. "Put up your shooting irons, or there'll be more dead men here." And they put them up and said it were a fair fight. "What became of Tutt?" I asked the captain, who had stopped at this point of his story and was very deliberately engaged in refilling his empty glass with whiskey. "Oh, Dave, he was as plucky a feller as ever drew trigger, but Lord bless you, it was no use. Bill never shoots twice at the same man, and his ball went through Dave's heart. He stood stock still for a second or two, then raised his arm as if to fire again. Then he swayed a little, staggered 3 or 4 steps, and then fell dead. So there we are, Sam. There's a real live example of a gunfight and some degree of honour there. But mainly, I imagine, as in the film, and not to spoil it, honour was not respected, and gunfighting was pretty down and dirty.
It was. I mean, there are so many topics which we haven't covered here. I actually got a list of them, James. I might inspire us to do more podcasts. But justice, I wrote down, fabrics, orphans, skin. We've just done skin, but the colour of skin and scarring. Revenge, also very important. And the music. I absolutely adored it, and it really made me think about the type of music they would have actually been listening to at the time. So music linked with immigration and in the 19th century, I thought that was something we could look into. And cross-dressing as well, I haven't mentioned that, but that actually plays quite an interesting part in the film, and it made me think of the wonderful novel Days Without End by Sebastian Barry, which is set in the Wild West. And it follows the adventures of Thomas McNulty, and there's some good cross-dressing in there. It makes for a wonderful story, as it does in this film as well. So there we go. Do go and watch the film. We absolutely loved it. Do get in touch with us if you want to suggest different ways we can think about the history of cowboys, and we'll have a think about that and see if we can fit them into future episodes. But for now, that's it. Thank you all so much for listening. Do follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime and naval history, please follow the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And if you want to follow me on social media, I'm at James Daybell. The podcast is on at Unexpected Pod, both on Twitter. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, so friend us there. Check out our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. And also, if you want to be a patron of Histories of the Unexpected, head over to Patreon, where we have an account. But in the meantime, go out and watch The Harder They Fall, which is currently in select cinemas and on Netflix from the 3rd of November.
That's it all for now, guys. Bye-bye then. Cheerio.
Bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.